cycling at thinkgreenfromhome.com. This is NHPR News.
Memories. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange.
And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania.
Martin Luther King's passing reference to New Hampshire has been noted by many a Granite Stater lately in the days leading up to the 50th anniversary of King's I Have a Dream speech that capped the March on Washington. More than 200,000 Americans gathered on the National Mall on that day, August 28, 1963. Among them, Northern New Englanders who've been reflecting upon this half-century observation and how they feel about it today. One participant was Kel Edwards, who's been a resident of Kittery, Maine for 48 years. At the time of the march, he was serving in the U.S. Army, based in Washington, D.C. We caught up with Mr. Edwards yesterday. Mr. Edwards, welcome.
Well, thank you so much.
You were 23 years old on that day in 1963, living in Washington, D.C., so getting to the march was obviously not a big journey for you. What was the city of Washington like, though? What are your memories, Mr. Edwards? I'm imagining that it was packed with people.
Yeah, the city was somewhat, I won't say tense, but everybody didn't know what to expect, you know, so it was not a terrible period, but it was a period where everybody was really hoping that things was going to go all right for the march.
Now, talk a little bit more about that. That's interesting. The city felt tense. How come?
Well, it did to me, because I think there were expectations that there would be violence of some sort, and the number of people that were expected to attend, I think that everybody was a little bit on edge in terms of, we got to be prepared for what might happen here. Of course, nothing happened, which was great.
So set the scene for us, if you could please, Mr. Edwards. That day on the Lincoln Memorial, what was it just like to be there with all those people from all over the country?
Well, it was great. And just to be there with all those people, and there was such a congenial atmosphere in my mind. Everybody was cooperative and everybody was very pleasant. There was no one getting upset if you happened to step on a toe or jostle somebody. All you got was, oh, that's no problem. That's fine, no problem, and with a smile. And it was just a great feeling to be there, expecting and knowing that something was going to happen as a result of this march. The country being put on notice that it was time for a change, and I just felt that this was going to be the thing, that the push that got everything going.
Yeah, a little more on that, if you could. Something was going to happen. What was the hope of you and others there of what would happen as a result of this?
Well, the things would get better for the African Americans in this country, that jobs would be available, the opportunities for promotion and advancement on these jobs. And this march was really the instrument that provided the impetus to get people mobilized, to know that African Americans were tired of the situation as it had been for so long, and it was time for change. And this was going to help in bringing about that change.
Where were you, Mr. Edwards, in relation to the stage? There, again, that big stretch of land in front of the Lincoln Memorial. Where were you in relation to the stage where Dr. King spoke?
If you're facing the Lincoln Memorial, I was somewhat to the right side and a little bit to the rear. I could see the stage from an angle. So I was fortunate enough that somehow I just worked my way through the crowd to get up close, so I wasn't way back beside the reflection pool.
Was the speech what you expected? Was the crowd what you expected? Was the day what you expected, Mr. Edwards? Or was it more than you expected?
I think it was more than I expected. I didn't expect nearly that many people, and I didn't know what to expect for all the speeches. But I think the I Have a Dream speech, which I understand that there was some decision as to whether he would do that speech or not, but I think the time was right for that speech and the stage was right for that speech for the whole country and the whole world at that time. I think it was very appropriate.
What do you remember most about the speech? Obviously, there are parts that, you know, have been played back and played back and played back over these last couple of weeks. What stands out for you, Mr. Edwards, again, given that you were there?
What stands out for me was when he made the comment about the time when African Americans or people would be judged on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. That really struck home to me.
Lots of reflection, as you know, on this 50th anniversary. Lots of talk about the legacy of that day, and here we are half a century later. What are your thoughts, Mr. Edwards, 50 years after this happened, about the legacy of that speech?
I think that speech prompted a lot of actions and activities on the part of private industry, and particularly government, and the nation as a whole, and did a lot toward us having a black president 50 years after that speech, which was just the farthest thing from my mind. I never thought I would see a black president in my lifetime. And I think that this speech, that march, had a large impact upon that.
Well, Kel Edwards, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much for sharing your memories and thoughts with us.
Well, you're quite welcome, and thank you for asking me.
That was Kel Edwards, a longtime resident of Kittery, Maine, reflecting on the March on Washington, which he attended 50 years ago today. This hour in The Exchange, we mark this anniversary with others from our region, looking at how this event, and especially this speech, changed our nation, also what has not changed. Let's hear from you, too. What's the legacy of this event a half century later? What's different about our country today? What's not different? And how do King's words, so often quoted, sound to our modern ears? Give us a call. Let's get your thoughts. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests in studio. Jerry Ann Bogus is here, director of the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail, also director of the Harriet Wilson Project. She lives in Milford. And Jerry Ann, a big welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dottie Morris, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism for Keene State College. Dottie lives in Vermont. And Dottie, it's nice to meet you. Thank you also for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, James McKim. He participated in a march in Charleston, South Carolina, met Martin Luther King when he was 9 years old. James is chair of the Diversity Committee of the Episcopal Diocese of New Hampshire. He lives in Goffstown. And James, it's been a while. Welcome back to you, too.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Well, and I want to start with you, James, because we're talking about this speech that Dr. King made and its huge impact on this country. You met Martin Luther King 4 years after the march in 1967. There was a march in your hometown, Charleston, South Carolina. What do you remember about that at the impressionable age of nine?
What I remember was the enormity of it all. We came to County Hall in Charleston with about 900 other people, and there was a lot of excitement in the air. You could tell something big was about to happen. And Dr. King and his entourage came in, and it was like a king, I mean, literally a king, was walking into the auditorium. And when he spoke, you could tell he was a very soft-spoken person, but once he got into his speech, he thundered. And the audience swooned with his just about his every word. So I remember that very vividly. Also, I remember the march. These hundreds of people marching down King Street, the main street in Charleston. I'd never been part of a group so large, and you could feel the emotion and the tension in the air. Great solidarity, and people also were there to, even though they knew that violence could happen, they were enjoying being together. And that feeling of togetherness is it was living the dream.
That's what I was so struck by with that interview we did earlier with Kel Edwards. You know, there were fears that violence could happen. And
absolutely,
yet, even with 250,000 people, a quarter of a million people gathered on the National Mall, he said he was nervous, and he was in the Army. He's a 23-year-old guy.
Right.
He was nervous that something could happen, and nothing did.
I think that's a testament to the preparation that went on behind the march. If you study how the march was put together and the various groups who were brought together, you know that there was a lot of communication with everyone who was coming to Washington that day. And there were people stationed all around the city to guide the people who were coming in by bus, by train, or whatever, and remind them that this was to be a nonviolent march.
Yeah, and people were also told, dress in your Sunday best.
Absolutely.
You know, use your Sunday manners, so to speak.
Right, and that wasn't too much of a stretch, unlike today when my parents always chided me for going out without a tie or without socks. Or today, we think nothing of that. But that was the way it was. When you went out of the house, you were supposed to be dressed to the nines.
Yeah, and I want to get some background from you, Jerry-Ann, and you too, Dottie, of course. And Jerry-Ann, your background's a little different. You moved here from Jamaica, I believe, in the 70s. Is that right, when you were a teenager?
In 77.
Yeah, so what do you remember about that time? I mean, it was good chunk of time later after the March on Washington, but you were in Alabama. So I'm wondering what sort of the feeling was around civil rights, around race relations and so forth at that time in Alabama.
Well, coming from Jamaica, coming from a country where you're the majority, was quite different than coming to a country where you are now in a minority role. And as a new immigrant, that's not something you really think about. Your character, who you are, is still that majority voice, so you carry yourself with that majority voice. But I do know that coming from Jamaica, we knew about the civil rights movement. We knew about racism. We knew about segregation. So when I went to Alabama, I know my mom had told me, now if anything happens, you know, just call us and we'll just bring you right back home. And what I really liked about being in the South, and I was glad my transition was from the South to the North, was that people were frank. They were upright. It was open. No matter what side of the fence they were on, if they liked you, they liked you. If they didn't like you, they didn't like you. And they would say why. So it was out in the open. There were still remnants of this segregation, and of course racism, and it was visible. You'd go the water fountains, the signs were gone, but the marking was still there. You could still see the four colored only signs. There were places that you would go where people would say, no, it's not your night tonight.
Oh, I think there's a story that we'll hear after the break. Yeah. Like you were trying to roller skate or something.
Yes.
And they said, no, honey, it's not your night.
Not your night.
All right. After short break, a lot more stories. And I do want to hear more about what you said, Jerry-Ann. You carry yourself in that majority voice. That's real interesting. So we'll talk about that after a break. I haven't forgotten about you either, Dottie. We will talk more. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning, and today is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Stay tuned to NHPR to hear events happening on the Mall, including speeches from President Carter and Clinton. Robin Young and Jeremy Hobson will be joined by NPR correspondents on the ground for this, as well as remarks from President Obama. It's the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Coverage begins at 2 this afternoon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forest and the Lakes Region Conservation Trust, working together to conserve Mount Major and the Belknap Mountains, ForestSociety.org. And from Dartmouth Community Medical School, presenting Discovery and Innovation in Health, It Takes a Team. Six lectures, September 17th through October 22nd. Details online, Dartmouth Community Medical School. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're remembering the March on Washington 50 years ago with Northern New Englanders. We have guests from Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire. Join us with your thoughts and reflections and questions on this march and its legacy with us today. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. With me in studio is James McKim. As he told us before the break, he participated in a march in Charleston, South Carolina, met Martin Luther King there. Today, James is chair of the Diversity Committee for the Episcopal Diocese of New Hampshire. Dottie Morris is also here, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism at Keene State College. She lives in Vermont. And Jerry-Ann Bogus, Director of the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail and Director of the Harriet Wilson Project. And Jerry-Ann, just before the break, you were telling us stories about coming here as a teenager, 16, I believe, so not a young teenager, from Jamaica, a majority black country. And you said, when you came here, I carried myself with that majority voice. I thought that was really interesting. What do you mean by that?
I think as a majority, you think differently, you act differently, you walk differently. You know, you're character, your carriage is different. The majority never has to think about the minority, what they're doing. So there is, again, from a majority country, there's a pride in who you are, in what you stand for, and you know who you are. You know your background. You know your relatives. You know your ancestor lineage. So you come with that knowledge that carries you forward in whatever you do. And it's that the way you talk. You know, there's this, you know, I think it, sometimes people thought we were arrogant, you know, because of the way we spoke. But it was just that we had the majority voice. So that knowledge and security in self of knowing who you are makes you talk differently.
And some of the whites in Alabama probably did not appreciate that.
No.
At that time. So segregation still, 1977, still segregation in the South. Not official, but
not
unofficial.
Not official, but definitely. The parties were segregated. The places for entertainment were segregated. Churches were segregated, which was really amazing to me, coming from Jamaica, to see a church segregated. The way worship was done is totally different, which, again, was amazing. But, yeah, the signs of Jim Crow were very visible.
Well, and I know Dottie has some experiences about that, too, for sure, growing up in Louisiana. I do want to invite our listeners again to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And first up is Joe in Exeter. Hi, Joe. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
Good morning. How are you this beautiful day?
Excellent.
Great. Thanks for the wonderful program. Are you there?
Yes, we are. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, that's good. That's good. 50 years ago, I was there.
Wow.
And I was in my early 20s. For a white boy coming from the North, I had never been with any black people. There weren't too many black people up here.
Were you living in New Hampshire, Joe, at the time?
Well, at the time, I'm from New Hampshire. I was doing some graduate study in Ottawa, Canada.
Oh, that is far up north. Okay.
Yes, it is. And I remember taking the train in Ottawa and all the way down to Washington, D.C., and the closer we were getting to Washington, D.C., the more the trains were packed with black people. And that was my first experience of black people. And I was warned to not to go down because I could get myself in trouble being you could say, innocent young boy. You know, that's white, never been exposed to any of this.
So and what made you decide to go, Joe?
Well, I really believed in the doctor's teaching of peaceful demonstration and equality for people. I had never been brought up to think that blacks were different than whites. That never was part of my experience.
Joe, you know, I wonder, since you were there, if you could share with us just briefly your memories of being on the mall after that long trip from Canada, and
yeah.
And what parts of the speech especially stirred you?
I really liked the part where he was talking about, you know, we need to demonstrate peacefully. We need to bring our point across. We need to bring about equality. And, you know, and we have to do that in a nonviolent way. And this is what had caught my attention, is that there was so much violence, because I had never experienced that, you know, growing up. And here I was in my early 20s. I had never experienced this violence. And I had a hard time relating to that at first. And I had to experience it. That's why I went down. I had to find out what black people really were like and how they felt, how they acted, because I had never had that before.
Well, Joe, thanks a lot for calling in, and good to hear your reflections on that day. 50 years ago, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Dottie, I did want to ask you your own experience, but also related to Joe in Exeter's call, this idea of nonviolence, peace. That's a huge, huge part, of course, what this march was all about and what Dr. King's message was. From what I understand, Dottie, when you were growing up in Louisiana, that time, the early 1960s, there was some violence directed at African Americans in your community.
Right. As a matter of fact, in my neighborhood, at the time we had the regional president of the NAACP living in our neighborhood, maybe three houses down. And I still have memories of crosses burning on his home, on the fence in front of his home. And it was really interesting because I can still remember the glow of those crosses. So
wow.
There's a certain kind of trauma around that glow. When I see that glow, I still become a little anxious about it. We also had across the street from us, kind of diagonally, a pastor of a church who was very socially active and had he was kind of like our Martin Luther King Jr. in our local community. And one night he was preparing a sermon in his church that was probably about five or six blocks away from his house. And he was shot and left to die. And had his two
awful.
Sons not gone in,
oh.
He would have died because the intent was to kill him. But he lived for many years because I think things work out as they are supposed to work out. Because, you know, after that event, it really did kind of motivate people to get more involved than they had been before.
You were little around the time
yes.
of Dr. King's speech, you know, 4 or 5 years
yes,
old, I'm
okay.
guessing, since
yeah.
you were born in 1959. But what sorts of impressions or conversations, Dottie, do you remember from that time period? What were the adults talking about? What were they worrying about?
Well, I think the biggest worry was about the young people. I know that my parents were more concerned about me and more concerned about my siblings, more concerned about the other children in the neighborhood than they were about themselves. So I think that this whole idea of, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants is not just an image that I have. It's real for me. And because I know that those people were making many sacrifices so I could sit here today. And so I think that that's what they were more concerned about. They had an understanding that they were dealing with something that was greater than themselves. And they were able to communicate that to me and I'm sure to my siblings and to all of the kids in my neighborhood and especially in my church as well.
You're nodding, James. I'd love to hear from you on that. You nodded vigorously
Boy.
When Dottie talked about the kids.
Yes.
The kids.
Well, the kids. My parents, too, were very much, and my parents were teachers, and they were very much giving all of themselves for the kids. And what also struck me is Dottie was talking about standing on shoulders. I was just thinking about that very phrase as I was driving in today. Our parents gave themselves so that we could stand on their shoulders, and we now have a responsibility to do great things based on that mm-hmm. so our kids can stand on our shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's what our parents, they recognized how they were going to survive mm-hmm. this trauma, mm-hmm. and they imparted that to us the best they could.
Well, so let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. Let's fast forward then. Okay, so here we are, 50th anniversary, lots of coverage, lots of conversation. Jerrianne, I know you have children. What does this half century mean to them? How do they view it differently than perhaps the four of us sitting in this room?
It's an odd place to be speaking for my children. because we live in a country where this history is not often told,
mm-hmm.
where the schools that they go to, it's not part of their curriculum. So all this history, this movement becomes to them is the sound bites and the one hero, the one person, I had a dream, you know, in this vision of utopia. But the life in which they live, my young men live, is so removed from that dream. I'll just say my sons are biracial. We grew up, they grew up in, they're New Hampshire born biracial young men. Until they were teenagers, you know, they lived, we all lived in a bubble of, you know, chocolate and milk, you know. I'll just say that. Until they were teenagers when they started driving. And that's when the bubble burst. And we became part of the African-American culture.
Wow.
You know, in that they were profiled. I can't remember how many times my sons were stopped in their cars. And the funny thing is, my husband, who is a police officer, would even be at work, and he'd get a, you know, he'd say, he'd hear a call come in that say, can you run this plate for me? I want to make sure the right guys are driving the right car. And they'd run the plates, and they say, well, is the young man of color driving it? Not in such terms, but nevertheless. And they'd say, yeah. They says, okay, well, leave them alone. They're, you know, my husband calls number kids. So even then, you know.
So his colleagues were...
Not necessarily his own kids.
Yeah, maybe?
Not necessarily his colleagues, but police officers from mm-hmm. other towns, because they would have the one call-in station. So, yeah. So
once they're teenagers, and then, things
and even before then, when they were younger, I knew I had to immerse them in a culture of color, because they weren't going to get that anywhere else, mm-hmm. and they weren't going to know who they were. I think just briefly, an incident happened where my son, when we went to a Burger King, and there was an African-American male serving that day, and he, you know, gave us the food, and my son stepped back, and he was little, and I was like, what was that all about? He said, I don't want to take it from him. And, you know, that was the first really, you know, young kid, and that's not what our house was all about. So it was like,
where did he get that?
Where did that come from? Where was that? And that was like, that started my own immersion into African American history and African American culture and being who we are, because it doesn't matter what you are in your house. When you step out that door, what you see is who you become.
Yeah, and that was a learning curve for you in a way, because again, you grew up in Jamaica.
Exactly. That was my wake-up call.
I want to bring another voice into our conversation now and remind our listeners, like Joe in Exeter, that you can call with your memories and questions at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Joining us now on the phone is Pernell Fred Ross Jr., statewide director of the NAACP in New Hampshire. And Mr. Ross, thanks a lot for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, your thoughts on this 50th anniversary. Wow, it's been a long time.
Yes, it has been a long time, and we've come a long ways. And like so many people have articulated before, still a long ways to go. We came here from Texas in 1981. At that time, I think the state population was right around 500,000. Of course, now it's about 1.7, so it's grown quite a bit. And my family and I, we elected to stay in New Hampshire because, in my view, New Hampshire had a lot of potential. It still does. The majority of people I've met and dealt with are well-educated, well-traveled. There's a lot of ignorance out there, not necessarily stupidity. Ignorance, in my view, you simply don't know.
Lack of experience, people, not necessarily.
Yes, most people, in fact, change once they learn something new. I'm retired military, 30-plus years, and I taught aerospace science and physical science at Spalding High School for 14 years and retired from there in 2000 and been very much involved in local activities.
Mr. Ross, can I ask a question about your military background? Because mm-hmm. from what I understand, you were in the military on that big day 50 years ago today on the March on Washington.
Oh, yeah.
What did that mean for you?
Well, what it really, at that time, I was up in northern Maine, a place called Caribou Limestone Loring Air Force Base. And back in those days, military folks were discouraged from getting involved in politics in any way. In fact, if you wrote your congressman or senator, you might not fare well when promotion roll around. Those things have changed. So
you were discouraged from going?
Not just me. Anyone in uniform at that time.
Sure.
There has been a lot of changes. However, what I decided to do is do what I could within the military to help ensure parity and equality among all of our folk. But I've been called the N-word twice in my adult life. And the first time was by a little kid in North Carolina who didn't know any better. And the second time by a bunch of white teenagers in Dover, New Hampshire, about almost 30 years ago. Again, ignorance have an awful lot to do with it, because my family is an international family. We have at our table from time to time people, members of the family who are French, Irish, from Turkey, from Germany.
Mr. Ross, so can I ask you a quick question just following up on something that you said earlier that was real interesting? You said, you know, and a lot of people have said this, but I'd love your thoughts. You said, yep, 50 years, it's a long time. A lot has changed here in New Hampshire. You came here, you know, in 1981. But we still have work to do, as you said. I wonder if you could elaborate on that second part there.
Absolutely. It occurred to me that there's not enough diversity and cultural training going on in the public school system. And I think it's at the detriment of all of the kids to not have more diversity. Because when they leave New Hampshire, it's a good chance they'll have to work for someone from a different race, maybe even a different country. And so while they may have a high school or college degree, they are really not prepared as much as they could be if there was more diversity in the school system. I was the only person of color in Rochester for 14 years.
Wow. What was that like, Mr. Ross?
Well, what it was like is that on occasion, kids would come from different places for, like from South America. When they see the only black teacher around, I'm the one they kind of tend to gravitate to. I had no problems with the teachers themselves. And I've also realized that the younger people don't seem to have a really big problem with racial issues. It's just that group over 50 who can't seem to get disengage themselves from the mindset of Jim Crow days. And unfortunately, a lot of these people are in a position to make decisions in terms of hiring or firing or not promoting, those kinds of things.
Oh, and Mr. Ross, thank you so much. We're heading into a break. So with my guests, I'm going to pick up on those themes that you talk about, diversity, how we feel about it, generational issues, real interesting. I really appreciate you being with us.
No problem. My pleasure.
Thank you. That's
you
Purnell.
Have a good one.
That's Purnell Fred Ross, Jr. Again, statewide director of the NAACP in New Hampshire. And all three of you, after a break, yes, let's pick up on those themes that he mentioned. We'll also take your calls. Your questions, comments, thoughts are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a shrinking government workforce and the U.S. economy, and then the legacy of the 1963 March on Washington. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny today. Chance of some scattered showers and thunderstorms. High temperatures, upper 70s to lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Rooted Group, servicing successful families and businesses with sophisticated planning and investment management for over 30 years at UBS Financial Services. Member FINRA SIPC. And from Brattleboro Retreat, helping people find the strength to overcome mental health and addiction challenges since 1834. Learn more at BrattleboroRetreat.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Northern New Englanders looking back on the March on Washington and its legacy with us 50 years ago. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. As we look back at this event a half century ago, what do you think? What's the legacy of the March on Washington? And especially Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. What do you think is different about our country today? What's not different? How do King's words, so often quoted, sound to our ears in this time? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, just before the break, we heard from the head of the NAACP here in New Hampshire, Purnell, Fred Ross Jr. And boy, there was a couple things he said that I'd love to follow up with the three of you on. I think, Dottie Morris, to you first, he mentioned diversity. He felt like there should be more education about diversity here in New Hampshire. I want to just back off from that a little bit. When we talk about diversity in college campuses, also in the workplaces, he said, well, how do you define diversity? Because some people hear that and they go, affirmative action.
Right. And they equate it with just race. But at King State College, I know that we've broadened that definition from race to class, sexual orientation, gender expression, ability, religion. The list goes on because all of those things inform who we are. And as a result of that, when we all sit around the table, even this morning, we've demonstrated that. You know, if you look at Jerry Ann and you talk to me, well, because of her early life in Jamaica, it makes her qualitatively different as an African being expressed in America, a little different. So that's the kind of thing that we have to talk about, because I think often people try to make things very generic. So if they know one part of your identity, I know everything about you. And so I think that part of what we attempt to do is to try to look at the complexities that are involved in life. And diversity is kind of the natural order of life, that we have to have diversity in order to have creativity. We have to have diversity in order to have innovation. Because if we're all thinking the same way, if we're all doing it the same way, we will just not have any more. So I think that that's part of what we have to think about. The other piece I want to raise around diversity is we are all diverse in some way or another, and we have to add this piece, is because of power and privilege and the legacy of oppression in this country, that there are certain parts of our diversity that might be weighted a lot heavier. So if we go with race, because of the legacy of racism in this country, our race might carry a little bit more of our identity or more about our experiences in this country. So if I walk into a room in New Hampshire, that part of me would be a lot more obvious than if I walked into that room and walked into yet another room in Louisiana. And so by my race, I might bring more diversity to the situation here in New Hampshire. But there are other parts of me that if I was in a room full of other African-American people, I would still bring some form of diversity into that room.
Yeah, but it would just be a different form of diversity.
It would be a different form, different aspect of my identity.
Maybe it's because you're female or you're from Louisiana or because you're, you know, in your mid-50s or whatever.
Definitely.
Yeah. What do you think about this question, James? And if I could add on to it, when people say, hey, March on Washington, 50 years later, laws have changed, no more Jim Crow, civil rights movement, Voting Rights Act, you know, who needs this affirmative action, quote-unquote special treatment. So just adding on to what Dottie said, but maybe adding in your thoughts there on this idea that we don't need affirmative action anymore. We're done.
I think we've got a long way to go, and I tie back to the I Have a Dream speech in that Dr. King was painting a vision for us, and we've not yet realized that vision. So we still need to take actions like affirmative action that will help us to achieve that vision. I was also thinking about how I'm a program manager at Hewlett-Packard. And as a huge corporation, one of the strengths that we see is in our diverse employee base. Because in order to sell successfully to the world, well, the world is diverse. The world is not just white American. So we have to have an employee base who understands intrinsically the same things that our customers understand.
So it's a strategic advantage, really.
Absolutely, a humongous strategic advantage, if I can use that word, humongous. For us to have a diverse workforce and for everyone on the workforce to understand diversity, given the really good definition that Dottie just gave us, it's not just about race. It's about creed, color, gender, sexual orientation, the whole nine yards. It's who we are.
Well, and picking up on one more thing that Purnell Fred Ross Jr. said, and this is for you, Jerry Ann Bogus. He talked about generational differences, and he said, I think people under 50 don't have a lot of these racial issues that older people have, and I just wonder what you think about that.
I think that thought and that belief is scary to me because of what we see. I think we've normalized racism in our younger kids. The words that we use to belittle, to desegregate, to make someone less than is normalized.
What do you mean by that? Because I think a lot of people have said what Mr. Ross said, that, you know, kids are better. They see, you know, the racist mixing on TV. We see it in advertising. We see it in music and so forth. But you're saying it's not that happy.
It scares me to think that way because, what I mean by normalized, we think we might have the laws and we may have more integration, but hearts and minds haven't really moved that much. And to see that in a generation that's younger is what's scary. And what I mean by that, the beliefs that I'll even talk on a college campus. If someone sees a young African American male, tall, athletic looking young male, he's an athlete. He's not there because he's in the engineering department. He's not there because he is studying English. He's there because he's an athlete, and he's immediately stigmatized as not being smart and only good at sports. The other thing that we see on our campus is if you're here because of affirmative action, you're here because we had to give you a scholarship to come here because you couldn't afford it, you know. And those thoughts are what are still predominantly, in the minds. I shouldn't say predominantly, but they're still there. So when someone say that our younger kids don't think or see race, that scares me because the heartfelt beliefs of stereotyped beliefs of our young are still there.
I'm really interested in what you have to say here too, Dottie, since given that you work at Keene State College, and you too, James, and then back to our listeners.
Right. I think that because I think people get mixed messages. On the one hand, you're supposed to love everyone. But on the other hand, we repeatedly are bombarded with messages that we're supposed to fear each other. And as a result of having those messages, that they're very confusing because I'm supposed to like black people, but I'm afraid of them because of what I hear in the media. And those two messages sometimes don't line up. Now, let's add on top of that, you have limited exposure to certain groups of people. So here in New Hampshire, as a result of getting mixed messages here, and then meeting someone in the flesh, it creates a certain kind of dilemma for the person who is responding to that African-American person or that Asian-American person or the person from, some part of Africa. It creates a certain dilemma. And I think in that moment, a lot of people will default to stereotypes. Because they haven't had a broad range of experiences with people, so it kind of they the person engages in a behavior automatically. It confirms the stereotype for them when they otherwise may not have noticed it if they didn't have that stereotype already in place. So, I think that when I interact with students on campus, a lot of them will say, even today, this is one of the first times I've ever had a conversation with. Like a real conversation as opposed to hi and bye or see somebody on a street or whatever. And I think that part of what we have to do is increase the opportunity to have those kind of conversations, increase the opportunity for students and other people to engage with one another in situations where they're working on a common task, because we know that that can help bridge certain kinds of things. And so I think that that's what I attempt to do, and other people on campus. We try to attempt to set up situations where students do have to interact, and they have to you have to stretch yourself, because it's easy to interact with people just quote like you, because it's easier to you use fewer words. We know that when you're interacting that way. So I think that it is pretty frightening to believe that young people are not being bombarded with the same messages, some of the same messages that I received when I was growing up.
James, to you.
Yeah, I was just thinking back to, I think, our first caller talked about how he, I think he said his parents brought him up not thinking that blacks were any different.
Even though he had no exposure.
Even that he had no experience. And I hearken back to what happens in the South versus what happens in the North. In the South, as Jolene said, it's out there. Everyone knows how everyone feels about you, whether it's good or bad. But in the North, it's not out there. You don't know how someone really feels about you. So I think that's what kind of scares us, that it's not talked about here in the North. You don't know. You don't have the chance to teach your kids about how to deal with us over 50 crowd who still have some of those Jim Crow kinds of thoughts and perspectives in our heads. So the education piece, as I said, my parents are educators. Education, to me, is a silver bullet. If you can educate people as to what's real, they'll proceed in the right way.
Let's take another call or two if we could. Lots of folks who want to join our conversation. And to Mary in Winchester. Hey, Mary, thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Good morning.
Hi, Laura. Sure, thanks. Shout out to Dottie Morris. Hi, Dottie. It's Mary Gannon from Vermont Partnership.
Hi there. How
are
you?
Hey, I'm good. I'm glad I could jump in. I just really appreciate the conversation, just the depth that you're all getting to in this very short amount of time. So I think just the piece is so many things to talk about, and this conversation could be, I think, Laura, you need to do a whole week on this. because part of what we work on at Vermont Partnership in Brattleboro, Vermont, is really looking at the issues that are affecting northern New England around just the changing demographic. And so race and racism, of course, is a huge priority for us. And a lot of the work that I try to do is really talking with how to get white folks involved in having these difficult conversations. And I heard this really powerful quote once from this economist who said that if white people got as angry and as frustrated about racism as folks of color did, then racism would no longer be an issue. And so I appreciate all the voices this morning bringing folks in from the NAACP. And what I really think is imperative and what I try to push in my work is really thinking about how white folks need to engage in this issue, that we can't keep relying on folks like Dottie, folks like Curtis Reed, who I work with, who have been engaged in this issue since they were born. But we as white folks need to figure out how to have these conversations, because I work in the schools, I work in the public sphere, and these issues are hard for people to talk to. We need cultural competence training. We're doing a disservice to our youth if we don't figure out ways to support them.
Mary, I did hear from somebody yesterday that the NAACP in New Hampshire was 90% white or something like that.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. I was not aware of that. And so that's good to hear. And I'm thinking, a lot of us that have been involved in this movement as well, that Dr. King and his colleagues started years ago, there was a diversity of folks. There were white folks. There were Jewish folks. We have Jonathan Daniels, of course, right here in Keene, New Hampshire, right? So that's good. And I think for me, it's just, everyday folks that are out here in the school systems, that are working at Walmart, that are, driving trucks, whatever it is that they're doing, we need to figure out ways of supporting those difficult conversations. And so, again, that's good to hear. There's a lot of white folks at the forefront.
The education piece, too, that you keep talking about, James. Yeah, Mary, thanks a lot for calling in. And, boy, hard to believe we have just 2 minutes left. And I did want to ask you guys just to look back and look forward. I know we've done a fair bit of that this hour. But in his speech, Martin Luther King said, 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Jerrianne, maybe to you first. What do you want to begin now? Here we are, 2013, 50 years after he said those words. What do we start now?
The programs like this, the conversation, open, honest dialogue, not defensive and turf-driven dialogue, but, the stories. The more we can relate to each other, the more we understand the story, what makes us who we are, that emotional piece, not the legislative piece, not the historical piece, but that emotional piece that makes us who we are, the more we can connect. And it's through that emotional piece, through that connection, that we can have an open, honest dialogue. And we have to be able to open up.
Sharing stories.
Sharing stories.
As
simple as that. Sharing stories. Because then we become individuals.
Instead of that stereotype that you mentioned earlier.
Instead of the stereotypes.
What do you think, Dottie? Here we are again. He said, this is not an end, but it's a beginning. So let's begin.
Right. And one thing that I think that people fail to realize about Dr. King is that he was able to be very confrontational and direct without being violent. And so some people think, oh, he was mean. No, he was very confrontational. If you read the speech or if you read the letter from the Birmingham jail, very much so. So what I want to do is have an opportunity that we can deconstruct systems that we have in place that perpetuate certain kind of pain that people are having. And it has to be conscious. It has to be intentional. And it has to be taking ownership that the past is having an impact on the current situation we find ourselves in, related to poverty, related to health discrepancy. So many things are related to systems that are in place that are unjust and that were created to be unequal. And we have to own that those systems are still in place in order to tear those systems down. And without that in place, I think that we'll continue to have the discrepancies and the disparities that we have.
James, you've got time, so I'd love to hear from you, too, on this.
Well, I think where I'd like to start with, as I said, Dr. King created for us a wonderful vision, a dream. And I'd like to, first of all, make sure that everyone hears and understands that dream. And after that, I'd like to shift the conversation from racism to diversity. One of the things that I did when I was asked, I was actually asked to chair the anti-racism committee of the Episcopal Diocese of New Hampshire, and I said to Bishop Gene Robinson, Gene, I will chair the committee if we can change the name to the Diversity Committee, because I think that's where we're going to have traction and be successful in thinking about people, as Dottie says, as individuals, not as a group.
All right. All of you, wish we had more time. Thank you very much for being here. Really
thanks
appreciate
for
it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
this
thanks.
Is great.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, what's next for nonprofits? There's a lot of soul-searching in this field nowadays, with some calling for a major rethinking of what it means to be nonprofit, including adopting ideas from the for-profit world. There's also debate over whether we have too many nonprofits and if some should merge, but others say those numbers simply reflect rising need. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange, tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on NHPR. New Hampshire weather partly sunny today with a chance of some scattered showers and thunderstorms. Today's high temperatures upper 70s to lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Raff Young and Pignatelli with law offices in Concord, Nashua, and Boston. National impact, uniquely New Hampshire. On the web at rafflaw.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVU, Concord.
89.1. WEBS, Nashua.
88.3. WEVH, Hanover.
91.3. WEVN, Keene.
90.7. WEVC, Gorham.
107.1. WEVJ, Jackson.
99.5. WEVF, Colebrook.
90.3. WEVQ, Littleton.
91.9. And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Frank Sesno from the George Washington University and planetforward.org, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The U.S. economy has added private sector jobs for 29 consecutive months now, but figures for the public sector have been dismal. Local, state, and federal employment has declined in 10 of the past 12 months. Some see this as a positive sign.